right. We're going to call the committee back to order. After recess, just to restate, this is the Monday, March 16th, 2015 committee hearing of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. And we are going to take up next Senate File 1705. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I had good afternoon on my notes, but I'll say good evening now. Thank you for hearing 1705. This updates current law. It's just modernizing terminology. I want to thank you all for starting the conversation last year on railroad safety. You updated the spill bill, response plan requirements, and training requirements. I have a lot of railroads in my district, and so I went to a lot of the governor's meetings and some other meetings with first responders, fire department, local communities, and the railroad, and we continue to have discussions on what was done last year and what still needed to be done. So as I was going to those meetings, I started reading some of the statutes relating to the response plan, and during that time, I came concerned about the potential cost to local governments. The statutes in this bill, language that is already current law, again, discusses damages if there is a railroad fire and reimbursement costs. So, Mr. Chair, I have an author's amendment to be the A1, right. And then I also have some oral amendments that are, I continue to have conversations with local communities through the weekend, actually, and we had some additional changes based on those continued conversations with the fire chiefs, local communities, and railroads. So the first section of the bill is...
So, Senator Dietzick, is the A1 a delete all?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
All right. All right, so we'll...
But
we'll
do
just
you want that coming around?
I can just keep talking. I don't... Right. I just have my copy. I can just kind of keep talking and
sure.
explain
yeah,
the bill if you
Great.
Want as we...
Great, thanks.
It's not a delete-all, but I actually like kind of walk through what I do. The first section of the bill updates Minnesota Statute Section 219.76, and this section, which was put into statute in 1909, mentioned a fire communicated by the engine. So I wanted to clarify what that means and update that the fire doesn't have to spark from an engine to kick into place. So I also added language so that a public entity can recover damages if the public property is impacted. If you look on the bill, you can see on the amendment, we are on lines, well, you don't have the amendment. So we're just doing some, adding some language and some comma on in the amendment. And then on, that goes into the next section. So basically, we're just updating that the fire is not communicated, but it's spread. We're adding in rolling stock or the contents of the rolling stock caused directly or indirectly by spill, tear, discharge, or combustion of the train contents. And then the next section updates 219.761, and this is relating to reimbursement costs. If a derailment or other emergency incident occurs, the amendment clarifies public costs for the reimbursement. If you look on the language, the bill originally had local government fire department. We removed some of that, but then we decided, after further conversations, that we needed to add back in local government entities so that public works costs could be included. That is line 1.9 of the amendment. And then I also have some oral amendments related to both sections when we're ready for
okay.
that.
Okay. So why don't we take the A1 author's amendment. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
No, opposed? Motion carries. All right. All right. And oral amendments.
So we'll start. We'll start with the second section. You can see that on line 2.1 and on line 210, we originally deleted nonprofit firefighting corporations. After discussion with League of Cities and some in the fire community, it is determined that those still exist. And they're usually small communities that merge together and have like a joint powers agreement to fight fires. And so we decided those need to go back in. And so the oral amendment would be on line 2.10. It would be after, so on the regular amendment, on line 1.9, we add or local government entity, and then we'd add comma, Nonprofit Firefighting Corporation extinguishes an emergency. Maybe wait, hold on. Sorry, that's on line 2.2. So it's an emergency responder, comma, local government entity, comma, nonprofit firefighting corporation responds to a fire.
All right.
So that's back in.
All right.
And then on line 2.10, we literally just put it back in where we crossed it out.
Reinstate the stricken language. All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Dietze.
All right. And then
we just have a
All right, Senator Dietzick, council suggests that we put a comma on line 2.10, put a comma after government. And
leave the stricken or stricken.
it's not stricken.
Oh, okay. That was. Sorry.
So a comma after government and a comma after a corporation and insert or. Oh, and then we need to strike the or. So, excuse me. So, I'll start again. So, on line 2.10, comma after government, strike the first or, insert a comma after corporation, insert the word or. That's it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Senator Carlson made those motions. All those motions.
And then,
all right.
I have a second oral amendment that just further clarifies, and I had this conversation with council on, in some chapters, a person is defined as person, corporation, company. It is not defined here, so we just kind of left it, but there was some suggestions that on line 1.10, we add after person, so it would be person, we'd add who is injured, comma. So it would read in damages to every person who is injured, comma.
Okay.
And then public or private entity isn't required, but again, some corporation is not defined, and so it's just not a C corp. So we kind of did it a little broader on public or private entity, and so we would add public or private entity, comma, or person whose property is injured, comma, damaged, or destroyed by fire.
Right. So the amendment is to insert who is injured, comma, after person in my 1.10.
And then later on in this sentence, in that same line, after entity, add or person whose property.
All right. Questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. All right. Senator Dietzick, anything further for your presentation of the bill?
No, thank you, members. Again, the bill is current law. This is just clarifying it. I don't know if anybody is left that is interested to testify or not.
All right. Would anyone like questions, members, on 1705? Would anyone like to testify on Senate File 1705?
Mr. Chair, move passage.
All right.
Of the Senate file.
Senator Champion will move Senate File 1705. He recommended to pass, but we can still take testimony in the midst of a motion. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and just for the record, I want you to know that we very strongly support Senator Dietzick's bill, and we have vetted this internally with our insurance trust and with some of our cities, and they're very appreciative that this will be taken care of this session. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify? Senator Senjoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just reading through here looking for unintended consequences. And, Senator Dietzick, if, for instance, there was a rail crossing accident,
yes,
where members of the public were injured on the railroad, would the railroad be responsible for reimbursing on those expenses, including medical expenses? I mean, I can't talk myself out of it as I read this.
My understanding is it is just for in the second section, it is just for costs and remedies to the local government entities.
Senator, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll trust you. I'll just have to read this some more, but it might be worth looking at.
All right. Anything further, members? All right. So called for testimony. This goes to judiciary. So Senator Champion moves. Okay, so Senator Champion moves that Senate File 1705, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Any questions on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Dietzig. All right, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Committee. I move that Senate File number 1525 be taken off the table.
All right. Senator, well, I think I put it on the table, so I'll just take it off the table.
Oh, gotcha.
We don't need to do a motion.
All right.
Senate File 1525 is taken from the table. That's right. We had to work out a couple of little issues, late-breaking issues.
Yes, so, and I'm going to turn it over to Eric Rudine from
Mr. Rudine, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. You might remember we walked through the bill last week, but there was an issue. We were contacted by an attorney very late in the process, actually the night before the hearing, who had some requests for modifications to the bill. And so there is, I think, being distributed an A1 amendment, which reflects our discussion with that individual. And it deletes this provisions in the bill related to the targeted group business and veteran-owned small business program goals. It clarifies that the prime contractor must either meet the goal or demonstrate those good faith efforts to meet the goal. It deletes language that was in the original bill related to a waiver. And so those are the main changes between the amendment and the original legislation. Mr. Chair, I think there was a typo perhaps on 1.11. The word effects, I think, should be effort. So it would refer to good faith efforts.
All right. Just incorporate that change. All right. Questions on the amendment, members? Senator Champion, you're comfortable with the A1 language? All right.
I'm comfortable with it, and I move that the A1 amendment be adopted.
All right. Everyone has it in front of them. Questions on the amendment, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Anything further on the bill, Senator Champion?
I think there was other person who wanted to say something.
So I'll call for public testimony. Would anyone like to testify on Senate File 1525? Mr. Coyle, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I understand the bill has been before you before, and I apologize for being late to the party, so I'll keep my comments very brief. I represent the Minnesota Environmental, the Eminent Domain Institute, which essentially is the condemnation bar in Minnesota. The bill includes a pilot program trying to set up an alternative to the court-supervised condemnation process that is longstanding in Minnesota. And very simply, what it does is it gives the commissioner the opportunity to use the ALJ process as a means of trying to review a condemnation case and determining damages. I apologize. This is a new provision to us. It's not something that was vetted with the condemnation bar. The primary concerns we have is it takes a really good process that we think works well, and it attempts to fix it, I guess, but we don't know what the problem is. The condemnation process today relies on local real estate experts who are knowledgeable about the market. They're court-supervised. They're appointed based on agreement between the landowner and the government agency, so there's consensus about who they are, and we think it generates an efficient process. The other concern, which is a little bit more subjective, I suppose, is the ALJ is essentially an extension of the executive agency, which is the Department of Transportation. And so there would be some concern, and I would say that very respectfully, that the ALJ is acting as fact finders and determiners of damages. There may be some sort of an inherent bias in the process that's being followed, and again, I'm not suggesting that would in fact be the case. But a court-supervised process obviously introduces the third-party independence that is what our judicial process is supposed to be about. So those are the concerns I wanted to raise, Mr. Chairman, and bring those before the committee. I understand this bill is going to be referred to judiciary, and so we can certainly pursue that conversation more directly there if that's the case. But I wanted to get those comments on the record this evening. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. Questions, members? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, relating to Section 10 there,
would you let this council know?
I have a question on that as long as we're there, and then I'd like to bump back to your amendment for a second as well. Do you anticipate a fiscal note on that? I would guess the Office of Administrative Hearings, are they going to come back and say this is going to cost them more at this point, do you know? Or
Senator Champion, Mr. Rudy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, the department would pay those costs as we currently pay the court costs in an eminent domain proceeding, so we don't anticipate there would be a significant difference in the cost, whether they go through the normal process or through this process. I would also point out that this is just a proposal for a pilot program, and it would only apply to five projects, and so we're not changing the entire system. This was just a proposal our Office of Land Management came up with to try a new approach and see if we can find any efficiencies in using this alternative approach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then Mr. Radin, so if I heard you correctly, then the Department of Transportation is going to just absorb those costs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, we would when the department undertakes an eminent domain proceeding, we are responsible for paying those court costs, and so whether it follows the normal process or follows this process, those would be costs that the department would pay as part of the eminent domain.
So it'd be a wash, in other words.
Correct, Mr. Right. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Then one more question, Senator Champion. Do you have a sense or have you any discussions with the commissioner relating to this concept of good faith effort? It says, you know, your amendment that was just added to the bill, it says the commissioner must establish a procedure for evaluating the good faith effort of contractors that do not meet the goal. You know, the one concern I would have is that it's kind of creating a relatively subjective decision there. You know, people have different opinions on what a good faith effort is. Do you have a sense for what that might include, that process? Or?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I could articulate my thoughts about that, but I think I will let the representative from MnDOT talk about the process and what's been in place for quite some time, so this is not new.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Kim Collins, and I'm the director of the Office of Civil Rights at MnDOT. Mr. Chair and committee members, the phrase good faith efforts is part of the process that we use within our preference programs, such as the Targeted Group Business Program. It also has another similar program under federal law, the DBE program, which is for disadvantaged businesses, also targeted towards women and minority participation. We are taking a page from the federal program that has well-established rules for our process for how you evaluate good faith efforts. And because those have been challenged under various courts and litigation, we know that yes, it's subjective. There is a way to reasonably conclude whether or not a contractor has made adequate good faith efforts by doing the kinds of things that they would do if they were trying to achieve a goal.
So Mr. Chair and Ms. Collins, so do you have a sense for what the features are? Do you look at the number of applicants they've taken in terms of that particular position and determine, if that is that an example of a good faith effort?
Ms. Collins.
Yes, it is. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, committee members. The good faith efforts are outlined that we use, again, following the federal regulations, There's about a 10-step process that you assess or evaluate. We look at solicitations and whether or not a prime contractor made an effort to solicit firms that are certified within the program. We also take a look at whether they made efforts to break out the work into what we consider economically feasible units to see if there's interest from small businesses to bid on those. We also take a look at what kind of follow-through they use, if they follow up in making a concerted effort with those firms that did express interest. We also take a look at the performance of other bidders in evaluating or comparing the commitment goal that one bidder submits versus that of others. So there's a series of different things that we would look at.
You assess how many certified contractors are in a given geographic area. I think that's one. Is that correct?
Yes. The location of contractors within proximity to the project, as well as for a given scope of work, what's the dollar value of that particular scope of work? Would it be reasonable for a business to travel that distance in order to complete that given task? So there are numerous factors, like I said, and they are outlined, they're documented. We internally within the office, then we have a process of a recommendation flowing through the individual specialist onto a supervisor who would further evaluate it, and eventually it would come to my desk for a final approval.
Senator Peterson.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Collins, why wouldn't we put the reference to the federal law in the bill and rather than just leaving it kind of open-ended? Does the Minnesota Department of Transportation, do they want to deviate from the federal guidelines at all? Or
Ms. Collins.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that's a very good question. We substantially mirror, under our state TGB program, we substantially mirror the federal good faith efforts analysis. I can't recall off the top of my head if there is anything unique that we've incorporated in the state program that's different than that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Anything else, members? Oh, I'm sorry. I have Senator Kiffmeyer and then Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question also about Section 10. And the question, I actually have a couple of them. One of them is, what was broken? What was wrong with the current that you came up with something different?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Rudy.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, it's been the department's experience that in some cases it's difficult to find the three commissioners that are appointed under the current system that have both a knowledge of the real estate market but also a thorough knowledge of the federal and state rules and laws that are supposed to apply as to what is compensable and what is not in an eminent domain proceeding. And so it was the hope that by using an administrative law judge that we would be able to find somebody who had a good knowledge of the applicable laws. And there have been some efficiency measures, too, that we would like to see if this process brings about some greater efficiencies. For one thing, we would be dealing with one party as opposed to three commissioners appointed. We've also had some difficulties getting things scheduled in the courts in these proceedings sometimes that have delayed eminent domain cases, and so we're hopeful that perhaps timelines can be speeded up on projects.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
I'd like to have the Eminent Bar Association testifier respond to that as well.
Go ahead.
The question I mentioned about what was the problem and why this, especially in light that they weren't peers anyway, just to have them comment on that subject.
Chair, Senator, frankly, from the bar's perspective, the process as it's currently designed works well. I certainly understand and respect the view of the agency that there can be a challenge on occasion identifying folks that are qualified. But our worry, aside from the separation of powers argument that I made earlier, our worry, frankly, is the ALJs have, you know, almost no experience in this area on a day-to-day basis. But the statute, at least today, requires that there be a lawyer, an appraiser, and a real estate professional involved on the condemnation panel, all of whom have to have relevant experience. And that decision process involves the landowner and the government agency that's the condemning body. So there has to be a consensus about that. And we just think that gets you better knowledge closer to the land, closer to where the taking occurs, that will help inform the taking and the valuation decision more precisely. That's as much as I could say.
And Mr. Senator Chair, Kiffmeyer. If I can just say to Senator Kiffmeyer, and I think the agency is attempting to do a good thing here, which is to explore it. They can only do up to 5 transportation projects. They still will have the existing system in place. And between now and even judiciary, there's always an opportunity for the parties to continue to talk. But we believe that this is a step in the right direction. So you're not subverting anything. You're just saying, hey, we want to explore these other possibilities as well.
Mr. Chair, I'm just a bit concerned here because you have an eminent bar group that is a great resource, and if that is kind of the premise of saying you want that expertise, well, this seems like the current situation as described does accomplish that, and I have concerns with both the conflict and the fact that I'm not convinced that anything was really not working as it should be. So, you know, with this particular section in this bill, it's not something that I find that I have been able to get the answers addressed to my questions sufficiently to support this.
Okay. Further. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Sendrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I too, would like to speak to Section 10. And I do it with some experience as a state legislator, maybe even a city council person, back in Rochester relative to Highway 52 and Highway 63, where I will just say forthrightly that MnDOT and their appraisal system and the agents, in some cases that they use, were way less than forthright with people, scared them absolutely to death in terms of what they were going to do with their property, in terms of, if you will, the taking, which needed to happen. But those same people and people like this that will experience, I think, this process, and maybe it's different in greater Minnesota than it is in urban Minnesota, but there's a trust factor in all this, and it just seems to me that the whole taking process now is being, I hate to say it, like stacked in MnDOT's direction, and the local folks who would rely on 3 commissioners, some of, frankly, who they might even know, but who I think would have some level of confidence in those commissioners from the standpoint of their understanding of the real estate landscape, wherever it might be, are much better suited to make these decisions than this all happening in St. Paul. I just don't see, at least for greater Minnesota people, that that's going to lend a whole lot of comfort. They're taking our land, and all that's going to be decided at some hearing up in St. Paul by some administrative hearing judge, a title which they've never heard of before. I just think it's way, way too bureaucratic, and I think we ought to think long and hard about going down this direction.
Senator Newman.
Well, I might as well weigh in on this.
I'm sorry, Senator Pratt. Skipped over. We'll get to
I will tell you that I don't see a whole lot of difference between an administrative law judge and a district court judge hearing an issue of this type with the expertise that is necessary. And customarily what happens is if they, the judge that's going to hear this case needs assistance, they will make sure that they get an expert witness in front of them that will explain to them the necessary information they have in order to make the decision. And it's very, very common. Neither administrative law judges nor district court judges are experts in all things. And consequently, they do rely heavily on experts in the field. And as I have stated for years, as a former administrative law judge, I think that the ALJs are perfectly capable of handling this type of a situation and would get the necessary help in the way of experts to assist them in making the decision. So I absolutely don't see any problem with this particular provision.
All right. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry about that.
Mr. Rudin, you mentioned that this was a cost and time-saving measure. Can you tell me how much the department expects to save if this process, assuming a pilot is meant to be a change in policy, potentially, how much do you think this will save you? And then also, I was just working on some eminent domain stuff with Mr. Coyle, and I came to understand that you can still take the property, you can still do what you need to do while the final amounts are being discussed. And so I'm struggling to see where the time and the monetary savings are.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, I think that's part of the reason for doing the pilot project, because we're hopeful that there could be some cost savings, but how we try it, we're not absolutely sure. But for example, the three commissioners who are appointed are reimbursed for travel and meals and in some cases perhaps lodging. So if we're not paying those costs and instead paying paying for one administrative law judge, then theoretically the cost should go down by two-thirds for those costs. So, that's part of the idea of doing this pilot program. You're correct that we can do what I believe is referred to as a quick take action, so that we can get title to the land and hopefully proceed with the project while the issue of compensation is still being determined by the court. But as I mentioned earlier, it has been our experience, and I don't know that it's incredibly common, but there are cases where we've had difficulty getting those hearings scheduled within the court system. I'm not sure the reasons why, if it's workload issues or what, or finding, as was mentioned, finding the commissioners that are qualified to sit on the case.
Right. Might I ask Mr. Coyle to respond?
Go ahead.
Well, I guess it's just a philosophical issue at heart. We trust the condemnation commissioner process that's already in statute, and with all due respect to Senator Newman, we think that the process that's closest to the property, the closest to the community where the land is being taken, provides for the best professional capability to deal with a takings claim involving property damage. And I understand that an administrative hearing examiner can play that role in lieu of a condemnation commissioner's panel, which is what is being proposed here. But you're still going to have the court playing a role down the road. And it just seems like it's creating a bureaucratic process that doesn't really move us towards getting to an acceptable damage amount, which is what everybody wants to get to. And so, as much as anything, we did not know this provision was coming forward. It's in a technical bill. It wasn't brought forward as a policy proposal by itself. So we don't have as much information about it as we would like to have. And I just needed to express our concerns about it on the record while there was a chance to do so this evening.
Senator Jensen, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to what you're talking about, and to address Senator Senjum too a little bit, I hope we're not transferring the cost that we'll be saving the department onto the people that will have to then do the travel and everything else compared to doing it locally like we're doing it now. I just want to bring that point up.
All right. Want to respond
to that point?
All right, Senator Newman.
To that point just raised by Senator Jensen, the cost when an administrative law judge becomes involved through the contested case hearings is borne by the agency that has requested their involvement. So in this case, there wouldn't be any transfer of costs. It would remain with the Department of Transportation. To Senator Senjum's point about keeping things closer to the people and to the land, very common for administrative law judges to travel and go out, and in a case of this type, they would actually go out into the area where the condemnation proceedings were to be held. The final point I would make is to go back to this separation of powers issue that has been discussed, and quite frankly, where you have the department that is doing or initiating the condemnation proceedings and then making the determination of the damages and the actual taking strikes me as being a lot more closer to the violation of the spirit of separation of powers than to transfer that decision-making process onto the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
I just want to make clear, I was talking about transportation costs for the people to have to go to the wherever the administrative hearing is now versus doing it locally at the district level. So I'm talking about the cost to them to have to travel.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, that can happen in their neighborhood, in their community.
Mr. Chair, as Senator Newman pointed out, the Office of Administrative Hearings does have offices throughout the state and holds hearings throughout the state, so they would not all have to come to St. Paul for these proceedings.
Okay. Anything further, members? All right.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Senjum.
I would say that when this happens to your constituents, you're not really terribly worried about cost or even efficiency. You're worried about certainly fairness. I'm not suggesting the administrative hearing judge could not do that, but I think the perception of fairness is what is really at stake here. And I fear going down this road we'll lose some of that. People, at least, again, speaking more for greater Minnesota, perhaps, where people know each other, and where people in many cases will know who these commissioners are, I think they feel, generally speaking, much more trusted in terms of the final decision than they would somebody working, if you will, for government.
All right. Thank you. Senator Kent, did I see your hand?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Anything further on Senate File 1525? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1525? Senator Champion, do you have a motion?
I have a motion, Mr. Chair, that I recommend that my motion is to recommend passage of Senate File number 1525 and that it go to
Judiciary. As amended.
As amended.
All right. Questions, members, on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion carries. All right. Thank you, Senator Champion. Now what? All right, Senator Carlson. 1473. Oh my gosh, another. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have Senate File 1473, Data Practices Regarding Disability Certificate Holders. Mr. Chair, members, current law classifies the Department of Public Safety data related to the holder of a disability certificate as private data, except that non-medical data may be released to law enforcement. In 2010, the City of Minneapolis moved its Traffic Control Division out of the Minneapolis Police Department and into the Regulatory Services Department. Current law also says that parking enforcement employees or agents of cities who enforce the misuse of disability parking certificates must be the law enforcement. There's a law 169.345 gives them the authority to report any abuse, misuse, and 169.346 gives them the authority to issue citations. However, the statute 13.169, which created the hang tag system, does not give parking enforcement employees or agents the access to the information needed to comply with this enforcement requirement. This bill adds the parking enforcement employees and parking enforcement agents to the list of those who may access the status information of disability parking certificate with the Department of Public Safety. As you may know, the hang tabs or the hang cards, the disability cards, are one of the most stolen pieces of stolen and counterfeited pieces of gear that are in the handicapped area. And what this does is this will allow the enforcement people the ability to look up by the number on the hang card as to whether that hang card status is current or is expired or has been canceled. With me, I have Ms. Clara Schmidt-Gonzalez, who is the Director of Traffic Control, to give you some more information from the Traffic Control people.
All right. Nice to see you, Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez. It's been a long time. I hope you're well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Dibble. I'm Clara Schmidt-Gonzalez, Deputy Director with Parking Enforcement and Traffic Control. And because of the recent changes to Chapter 13 and some of the changes in interpretation, we've been denied access to the disability certificate data that we once had. So our enforcement efforts have gone from finding around 209 fraudulent certificates out there to actually only finding two that we could document, because we had to, of course, be able to see everything that was wrong with it. We couldn't check official records. So just historically, our department has been involved in disability enforcement for a long time. There's a long history of working in this area, and our efforts have been appreciated by the people who legitimately use these types of certificates. The change before you allows parking enforcement personnel of home rule or statutory cities and towns to access non-medical data related to the status of the permit for the specific purpose of enforcing 169.345 and 169.346. We have a civilian structure, and again, we currently don't have access to this data. It's true that the police can enforce this type of violation. However, they have many priorities, and many of them higher than this, and it turns out that this doesn't get much personnel time applied to it because of all those other competing things that they're required to do. This change is supported by the Minneapolis Advisory Committee on People with Disabilities and by the State Council on Disability, and we ask for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez. Questions, members? All right, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Ms. Gonzalez. Is it conceivable to think that this data would ever be used in conjunction with license plate readers?
Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez.
I'm not aware that anything like that would happen. Our current process, so I'm not aware that it's at all used in license plate recognition. Our current process would be to access the data with a computer in the office and find out whether the data was, whether the certificate was valid or not, and then radio our field staff that it was or wasn't valid. So they don't use computers in vehicles in the field. Our staff don't. The information would be accessed by someone in the office.
And Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez, the hang tags aren't connected to a vehicle at all. They go with the individual. An individual can carry them with them, and no matter what vehicle they're in, they can use the hang tag for their purposes.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Yes.
Thank you. All right, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gonzalez-Schmidt, I'm thinking of my grandmother who would come up from Iowa, and we would hang her tag in the windshield. Can you check tags from other states?
Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, we cannot.
So we have to, Senator Pratt.
So in that scenario, you've got somebody parked in a spot. You can't validate the tag. how would you treat that? Would you ticket the individual? How would that, what would that process be if you can't validate it?
So the other way of asking is, are hang tags from other states legally used in the disability spots?
I'm assuming they are, or at least we broke the law several times. But
on the record,
I guess
this is taped.
Yes.
Senator Pratt. Ms. Schmidt comes on.
Mr. Chair,
that's right.
And Senator, if it's properly hung and we can see the month and the year, we honor it. The problem that we're trying to address here is that often if it's a fraudulent use, it's partially covered up, either by something else on the visor or by being laid on the dash. And so you'll be able to see the month, but you won't be able to see the year. And so anything that's clearly visible, we honor. If we can't clearly prove that it's invalid, then we would not take enforcement action.
Thank you.
All right. Right, I see that. I see that. Anything further, members? Any questions? All right. Would anyone like to testify? Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just take a seat, Mr. Neumeister. We'll get to you.
Just to, I was going to add in a comment in regards to the fraudulent use. You may have noticed, I'm a co-author on this bill with Senator Westrum, and there has been significant fraudulent use in one of the cities I serve, primarily on the college campus, and so I'm not sure if that's rampant on college campuses in general, but I know on an annual basis I probably get 10 or 12 calls from folks who believe that there's, particularly on St. Cloud State University, and I believe this would allow, because the city of St. Cloud's a home rural charter city, would allow us to get at that problem on that particular campus. Is that accurate, Senator Carlson?
Senator Carlson.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, yes, I would assume that that's correct, because, again, parking enforcement would not have to be done by the police.
All right. I see Mr. Neumeister waving and hopping, so come to the table, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I was here for today on two bills. One, Senator Rest has already taken care of that issue. I thank you. The second one, again, that one deals with data. This one does a second one. On lines 1.14, it says other data on holders. So what is that other data that's going to be released? Now, a similar thing that you may hear on a future bill tonight is that the author of that particular bill recognized that it's important to be specific in what you want to be shared. So, and there may be an amendment to that particular bill that I will not be speaking on. But on this particular bill, what is the data that they want? What do they want to compare? Based on my reading, my understanding is that they will not get any medical data on the holders, and I hope that will be the case. But again, what is the definition of other data on holders? And if this is going to be referred to the Judiciary Committee, whether or not the chief author, Senator Carlson, and the supporters of this bill want to just think, you know, to be more specific or whatever it might be. It seems like when I look at the law enforcement does get some information. But again, when bills like this come through, it always gives an opportunity for the policymakers to review what kind of information is being shared, because people are constantly. So that was my first question that I encourage you to ask.
Mr. Neumeister, I don't understand your question.
What is other data on holders?
Mr. Neumeister, please don't interrupt me.
I apologize.
Here's how the existing language reads. It says, following government data of the Department of Public Safety are private data, colon, other data on holders of a disability certificate. That's existing law. Except that data that are not medical data may be released to law enforcement agencies and parking enforcement employees or agents of statutory home rule charter cities and towns. So that, as Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez has explained, is whether or not an existing tag is current or not.
And then, Mr. Chairman, my question is, what is that other data that they're getting? It seems like they're not getting, as how I read it, not medical data, but what other kinds of data are they getting?
Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez, do you have a response?
Mr. Chair, Senators, we're mainly interested in whether the certificate is valid or not. At this point, there might be some circumstance where we might access a name and address, but that would be rare, and it's not something that we absolutely need. We're, for the most part, dealing with the status of the certificate and then dealing with the registered owner, who is the violator.
Senator Carlson.
And Mr. Chair, I guess I'm reading it differently here, and maybe counsel could help, that the following data are private, and it's number one, that type, that's medical data, and number two, that's other data. And then it gives the exception that data that are not medical data may be released to law enforcement. So I think the number two, the other data, is are other things that may or may not be needed to be released. If that's the way, if that's, maybe counsel could help. Is there information there that is not to be released for parking enforcement?
Mr. Chair, oh. And Senator Carlson, I think I read it the same way you do, that so it says the following data are private, then clause one. Everything in clause one is private. Then we add to that clause two, and that is private. So other data is also private, except for the existing carve-out on 1.12 and then the new language on 113 and 14. So everything else relating to the disability certificate under 345 is private.
Mr. Chairman, that's the that's the policy question. What other data do you want? Do you want just any data that's other data, or do you want it specifically for the purpose of what they want? And that's a policy question that you have to ask yourselves, and that's why I just bring it to your attention. And Mr. Chairman, in regards to license plate readers being used with parking situations, Minneapolis was doing it several years ago. And some cities have been asking themselves about why not use LPRs in parking situations as a way of enforcement. But that's another issue. So I thought I'd bring that to your attention.
It's a matter for a different day.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very, very much for the few moments of your
time. So, Senator Westrom.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to get everything open here, but I think I followed the discussion. And Mr. Neumeister, if I detect, if I understand what you're asking, and I'm thinking proposed language, but let me, one, we could either get rid of the words or other data, which would just limit it to what they said they need. Another way could otherwise be or other data necessary for the purpose that they're stating, which isn't exact language, but I mean, then you'd describe other data by saying necessary for this purpose. Are those two possibilities based on what you're what you were talking about,
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Neumeister,
Senator, that is a possibility. But the other possibility is that, you know, be given to the parking folks to verify whether or not the certificate is valid or not. Again, this is the purpose that they're describing it, why they want access to it. So they get on the radio and they say, "Hey, I got this." And so they'll say it's valid or not valid, and then you do whatever you need to do. Give a ticket. Then so you may need the name and all that in that regards. It's just a point, Mr. Chair, that I was just asking what other data is.
I see your point. This is similar to the conversation we had with Senator Rest. What is the minimal data that is needed, and should we describe that specifically? I mean, if I heard Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez correctly, the minimal data that's needed is whether or not a given disabilities parking certificate is current.
or not.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
To make that clear, would we, the people who are interested in this, entertain having after on line 1.12, after the and, where it says and necessary data for purposes of enforcing, or data necessary for purposes, or data only data necessary for the purposes of enforcement.
And, Mr. Chairman, I have another idea, if you're looking for multiples.
All right. All right. So so I have one idea, which would say, and only data necessary for purposes. Senator Kiffmeyer, what's your suggestion?
To me, that I appreciate that effort, but that I think what we found before was being specific about what you do want. And so on line 1.11, I struck the other data and just put certificate status on holders of a disability certificate under section 169.345, and then strike except that data that are not medical data. And so it would read certificate status on holders of a disability certificate under section 169.345 may be released to law enforcement agencies, strike and, for purposes of enforcement, and so on.
Except, Senator Kiffmeyer, the purpose of the language...
It's for the exceptions, yes.
Well, the original, the purpose of the language in the first clause is to classify all other data private. So I don't know if that would work in that particular spot.
It needs to go to law enforcement.
Well, we may be mixing two sections
There's two purposes of paragraph two. One is to classify particular data private and then create an exception. It probably should be broken out into a separate paragraph. But,
Council, yes. Mr. Chair, does Mr. Council have any feedback?
Well, I think maybe that first approach might work.
So Senator Carlson's suggestion, would it read, except shouldn't the only data necessary apply to both law enforcement and parking enforcement employees?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rest and then Senator Pratt.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, isn't the purpose of the whole bill just to add another exception, and that is to parking enforcement? I mean...
Yes, yes. So what Mr. Neumeister was suggesting is that...
Private, because that's what the first part of the subdivision 1017 says. And currently in law, it's that except that data that are not medical data may be released to law enforcement agencies. That's one. And you can release that same data that's in current law to parking enforcement. It's just adding for people that go around checking parking tickets or something. So I don't think we want to mess around with line 111 myself. It really changes the scope of the bill, it seems to me.
Well, the problem is we don't know, like we knew with your bill, we don't know what data exists on holders of a disability certificate. We don't have that convenient list that you had.
Well,
but we don't know what
Chairman,
data.
Though.
It's private.
It's private. Well, what is section 169.345?
Let me tell you what it is. I got it right here.
Mr. Gonzalez, 169.345 and 169.346, what are those? Oh, those are disability parking regs.
Mr. Chair Dibble and committee members, 169.345 talks about the disability parking privileges, and then 169.346, if I recall correctly, describes more the process of how one accesses the privileges but for the certificate. And within both of those statutes, there are sections that call for enforcement for penalties if the privilege is abused. So these two statutes specifically deal with either areas that have a disability parking sign on them saying that only those with disability privileges can park in those spots, and we enforce those sections. And then there are other sections that allow people who get a disability certificate or license plate to have some privileges to park in certain signed areas in cities, basically areas where there aren't limited time zone parking privileges.
Thank you. Council, any suggestion? I mean, just want to like, restrict the data a little bit, similar to what we did with Senator Resky.
Right.
Make a suggestion.
Mr. Chair, well, I've just been reading through 169.345, and it really the almost everything that I can see that's required to be submitted is medical information. There is also such a thing as under that same chapter as an organization certificate, where an organization that provides transportation to disabled persons can get a certain number of the placards that they can then use on their vehicles. So really the only data that's referenced in this chapter is medical information, and then information concerning these organizations. So I guess, I don't know, to me,
what kind
let
of
me just think for a minute about the wording. But.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
So what's the point of that old statute right there? I mean, what kind of data is, if it's all under 169.345, you can't find anything other than medical data. It's kind of like no problem, no solution. I mean, what is it like their names? Oh, what of the person? Is that what it would be? Name and address?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I assume it has to, as the testifier had stated before, I assume it has to do with the period of validity of the placard would be the major item of information that the enforcement would be looking for.
Okay.
So I would suggest that the language that Senator Carlson suggested, only data necessary does no harm and would confine the data that parking enforcement authorities could obtain would be restricted to some degree. Mm-hmm. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as I've been looking at this and based on the reaction to Senator Kiffmeyer's suggestion, it seems to me that we could say we could keep other data on holders that is classified private, except disability certificate statuses may be released, and then we would strike that are not medical in nature, right? And so then we are narrowing it down without doing away with the exemption of medical data and classifying all data with that exception of status as the ability to be released.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you still would want the name of the certificate of the placard holder, and you would want perhaps the registered vehicle. I mean, I don't know if they would leave a tag on the vehicle. It might not be, you know, the placard holder's vehicle. But they would.
Right.
Yeah, so just for purposes of enforcement, they might need the name, address, perhaps if they're mailing a citation or revoking the certificate, which is one of the consequences under this statute for improper use.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fierzowski, but revocation or I mean, the officer could cite, But revocation or any other penalty would have to be administered by the court, correct?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Yes. I mean, unless it's on a payable that you, but you know, that you could just pay a ticket. But the revocation, yes, I would think one would have to either go to court or else the commissioner probably could revoke.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that what we're talking about is whether or not the certificate is valid or not valid, and the officer would determine whether or not to cite or not cite that vehicle at the time, not about mailing or anything else. I believe my suggestion would keep within the spirit of what Senator Carlson's trying to do and yet accomplish with what we did with Senator Rust's bill in really tightening down what other information is not considered private.
Senator Carlson.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez will add some things that we've talked about just recently here.
Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez, what?
Chair Dibble and committee members, the only other information that I can think of that we would ever use is, as legal counsel indicated, a name and address. And right now for parking violations, we have been authorized by DMV to access that. So we have to abide by all the rules and regulations about accessing motor vehicle registration information only and properly using it. But we already can get name and address for registration motor vehicle issues for parking violations. So name and address under this particular clause would be the same or, you know, similar to that. It's a parking violation. In most cases, we're going to want the name and address of the registered owner because that's who is violating the parking regulations, not anything to do with the certificate holder. Most often, they're the ones who have lost their certificate or reported it lost or stolen. So it's accessing really the data that we already can access in the process.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. Ms. Gonzalez, is that then what you described seems to be the registration information coming from the license plate, not the certificate?
Schmidt Gonzalez.
And that's where I'm trying to.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that is exactly right. So our process would be if we found a fraudulent certificate or something that was reported lost or stolen, our process is to tow the vehicle, and then we meet the owner at the impound lot and issue the ticket to the registered owner. And so we don't deal with the certificate holder per se. We return invalid certificates to the state offices.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. I think this is a very unique situation where so often these things go with the car. In this case, it's a bifurcated process. So you have a certificate holder who has a certificate, and it's tied to a specific vehicle. Right. And so the person, an elderly person, can be riding with their children. They take their holder with them, put it on that car, and they're good to go, and they can park and do those things. So it's kind of a unusual situation, and just remember that. And I've carried a bill on this before a few years ago, so I got a really good education from the disability community on that very issue very clearly from them. And so it really helps when you separate those two, and that's what I think Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez did a good job of us getting to that point of understanding that distinction, which is really important in this regard. So what you need from the certificate holder in particular, which is what this subdivision 2 is about, is the status of that certificate.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that is correct.
And so the question is, which language kind of gets us there in the most polite way of finessing it, and whether it's Senator Pratt or Senator Carson or a combination of them.
Right. Remember, this is going to go through the same process in judiciary, where they really like to dig into this subject. Senator Westrom.
And I'm not on this.
Mr. Chair, for the matter of moving things along, I think Senator Carlson, maybe his language does get to the intention. But I did have a question quick for Ms. Gonzalez, and then I was going to suggest maybe we just move that language if people are okay with it. But did you say in these situations, if you find out they're invalid, you toll and then you issue the ticket? Or do you issue tickets on the street so when they come back they have a parking ticket?
They've already towed it.
Or how does that happen?
Schmidt Gonzalez.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we do not issue the ticket at the time of the we issue a parking ticket at the time of the violation. We tow the vehicle to the impound lot. The violation about any certificate misuse is issued at the impound lot because it's the registered owner of the vehicle that we want to see. Sometimes a driver will come with the owner and they'll say, you know, I'm sorry, it's me. You know, I'm the one that did it. The owner's not responsible. Then we'll issue the ticket to that driver that wants to take responsibility.
Mr. Chair, and maybe this gets a little far afield, but so we're trying to have an agency here approved to enforce the law, but I guess what caught me by surprise is that you would go to the extreme of towing the vehicle just over this alleged violation, and maybe there's an explanation, but it seems like a lot of cost and trouble when the message could get sent loud and clear with just a parking ticket violation, which might be a hefty fine to begin with, but I just... that really isn't anything to do with this bill, but that process surprises me, I guess.
And
Ms. Schmidt Gonzalez.
Mr. Chair and Senator, there's a couple of things. We're actually required by statute to return a fraudulent certificate. So once we determine that certificate is invalid, we're required to return it to the State Public Safety Office. And on top of that, this is a situation where there's evidence within the vehicle of this crime, and this isn't just a petty misdemeanor. This is a misdemeanor violation.
So, Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez, how do you so you tow the car?
That's correct.
And how do you get into the car to obtain the certificate? Do you use a little... and unlock it, or how do you get in there and get it?
The impound lot does have staff that can unlock it. Most often what we do is wait for the owner to show up and meet them at the impound lot and issue the ticket once we've talked with the owner.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
So on this process, I mean, that works as long as everybody's guilty. Do you ever run across a scenario where somebody's not guilty and now you've got a towing bill that somebody's got to pay? And it seems like a lot of process, but I hear what if you're trying to recover the certificate. I mean, I can just think of the scenario, one expired and the new one came and somehow the new one fell on the ground and all you saw was the old one. But what do you ever find a not a non-guilty party?
Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I cannot think of a situation like that, but if we had access to the name and address, that would be something we could check at the impound lot when someone came in and said, you know, I'm really sorry, but I made a mistake. If we could verify that certificate really did belong to this other person and and they could show us the valid one, it might be something that, you know, would make us say, well, you know, we're going to cancel the ticket, and we can, in fact, reverse the tow charges to our department. But if I can't access the name and address, then I can't do that process. The Violations Bureau can, but I wouldn't be able to.
Last comment, Mr. Chair. So here I guess what caught my attention is the purpose for this bill that I understood when they came around and not talked to us was to just add the parking agents to the bill if you're not part of the law enforcement.
But the bill does.
That's what we do. But here's the point. So we're trying to access this information, but what you just said is you're going to tow it to the parking lot, the impound lot, before you access the information. I would have thought you would have accessed the information by the tag hanging or sitting on the dash, if you can get the right information from there. But therein lies the problem. To go ahead and tow the vehicle and then go access the information seems to me to have a little bit of a problem yet. But for the purposes of moving this, I think we can continue that discussion, but I see a bit of a problem with that process.
And
Commissioner Gonzalez.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I would just point out that this is one of the more substantial violations and substantial fines that go with that. And so we want to be sure that we have the right party. Sometimes when people show up at the impound lot, they say, lo and behold, you know, I just bought this vehicle, you know, 3 days ago. It's, you know, it's not really me on the state record. I didn't transfer the title yet. So we want to be sure about all that information. And on top of that, we have the evidence in the vehicle that the certificate is not, we already, that we verify ahead of time that it is, in fact, a certificate that's reported lost or stolen. It is totally invalid. We do not do anything with certificates that are expired less than 90 days. We give a long time on anything expired. We're really talking about the misuse of a certificate. And there is a big black market in the misuse of this certificate. That's really what we're trying to get at and take some enforcement action about in this circumstance.
All right. Senator Thomason.
Well, I think she might have cleared up my concern, because based on what Senator Westrom was getting at, I was very concerned that you were towing the vehicle of a disabled person who actually could need his car when he gets back to the car. Sounds like you're not doing that, but I'm hoping you're not.
All right. Look, I say that's shaking at the table. They are not doing that. So, Senator Carlson, I think we were going to try out your language. Council has some adjustments to that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, let's see here. Okay. My suggestion would be 1.13. At the beginning of the line, insert only data that is necessary.
Yes.
And then I added after 169.346 later in that same line, I added may be released to make it easier to follow the sentence.
So does everyone understand the amendment? So at the beginning of line 1.13, only data that is necessary, and it would go on to read, for purposes of enforcement of sections 169.345 and 169.346, comma, may be released to parking enforcement employees, et cetera.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
it doesn't still doesn't clarify what that other data is. I think if you added something like certificate status or something that designates that is the specific thing that they are asking for, that they're not asking for just a vague other data. So if we can make that or specific?
So, Senator Kiffmeyer, we determined we needed more than just certificate status. We need name and address.
Is that?
Mr. Chair, that, Senator Carlson. That access is already within their ability. So really it is just the status, from what I understand, that they need. It is just whether or not it is a valid certificate.
All right. Someone else come up with an amendment then.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I think we should leave it the way it is. Because, right. not with the amendment, without the amendment, because right. I think any data necessary could mean anything.
That's right.
And they could access anything they want, and I think it actually opens it up more. So I think you should just leave it the way it is, since it's been working for how many years like this?
Just adding parking.
Yeah,
it's
just
not
leave.
Changing
just,
the
yeah,
law.
Just leave the new language the way it is, and not change
Chair,
the other data holders.
We
had
we
an
do
enjoyable
have a
half hour, 45 minutes.
Exactly.
Full circle.
Mr. Chair, we do have a trip to the judiciary too.
We're too committed.
All right.
Senator,
do
so
I have a motion on the bill?
We'll fix it.
Carlson's bill.
It's your bill.
Yes.
Motion. Mr. Chair, I would like to move Senate File 1473. Be recommended to pass and forward to judiciary.
All in question, would anyone else like to testify? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Motion carried. That was fun.
We almost lost the runners on that one.
Physically.
This is all about that. That's why I didn't want to get paid. I'm going to give all
this. Right. All right. Welcome, Senator Rest,
to
the table.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm one of those elderly people that you refer to that has a certificate. So if you don't think I'm going to remember that. So, Mr. Chairman,
the sad thing is,
Mr. Chairman, and members, Senate File 918 is a bill that would require in Minnesota a two-person train crew. And this issue was brought to my attention earlier this year as a railroad safety issue for workers and the general public alike. We often hear from the railroad representatives that almost anything that states try to do is federally preempted. But that's not the case with regard to safety issues such as this one. The states of both Arizona and Wisconsin currently have two-person train crew statutes. And also, occasionally, the issue would be brought up, well, this invades labor contracts. And that is not the case either. The legislation has no application to labor contracts or agreements. Railroad safety and public security are not appropriate subjects before any collective bargaining process. So it's a fairly straightforward bill. I do have an author's amendment, and then I will step aside to have the testimony presented and to get into the details of this policy change and why we need it in Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman, I move the A2.
All right. I don't think it's at everyone's place. We'll have that distributed, Senator Rest.
I have it, so.
Thank you.
against him, and I usually do.
All right. So I believe the A2 has made it around. This is an author's amendment. All in favor of the A2, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And now I will move over and let the testifiers explain what's going on in Minnesota and why this would be good public policy.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Wally.
Committee members, good evening. I am Philip Qualley, State Director for Smart Transportation Division, formerly the UTU, representing the regulatory and safety interests of 1,400 railroad conductors, switch persons, yard masters, and remote control operators in Minnesota. We are pleased to be joined by several members tonight, as well as our counsel, Larry Mann. Today, we respectfully request the Senate to support Senate File 918 that will require two persons on all Class 1 and 2 freight trains in Minnesota. This is essentially a policy bill with no fiscal note. Currently, we have two persons on all trains. This bill will not pose an undue burden on railroad commerce. As railroad workers, we assert it is in the public interest to assure trains can be uncoupled and grade crossings can be opened when long trains stand and block passage of vehicles, pedestrians, or emergency response vehicles. It is essential to the safe operation that workers are in a position on trains to keep the right of public highway access open. Another public benefit of Senate File 918, a two-person crew law will assure continued inspections of moving train equipment that will lower the potential for derailment, assure train securement so standing trains and cars do not roll away, and assure in-cab crew resource management. Failure in any one of these areas can cause derailment and damage to public and private landowners. From ignition of brush fires, from sparks on the train, to the release of hazardous materials which can have catastrophic consequence, we need two persons on a machine this size. Two very quick examples show a contrast. I would like to refer to the July 6, 2013 Lac-Mégantic, I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, my apologies to Canada, Lac-Mégantic Quebec train derailment, where one person could not perform train securement properly. Unqualified individuals tended to the train. The train rolled away, and we lost 47 souls. In contrast, the Castleton, North Dakota train derailment, approximately 17 months ago, we had two persons on the train crew, and the conductor did miraculous work walking back in towards the fire and uncoupling the train cars and removing more oil commodity out of the burn zone area. This is what we do as train crews, and this is what has occurred in West Virginia, recent train derailment, so on and so forth. Another public benefit of Senate File 918 will assure a worker's right and responsibility to provide Samaritan emergency response to injured persons after grade crossing collisions with trains. It is the train person who first attends to the injured person. When an EMT arrives, we must be there to immediately so EMTs can climb on, under, or about railroad equipment as safely as possible. After collisions, a train's brakes, cars, and safety appliances may be damaged, and direct radio contact with the engineer from the ground with the EMTs is essential for all concerned safety. Regarding grade crossing emergency response, for the railroad workers of Minnesota, I submit that we simply cannot leave injured persons lying in our ditches. Very quickly, I want to clarify that railroad safety is not a subject under the purview of collective bargaining. We reject any assertions by the carriers that public safety is appropriate within any collective bargaining process. Senate File 1918 legislation has no reference to union contracts, agreements, or designation of persons. The impetus for this legislation was BNSF's attempt last summer to operate with one-person crews. Railroad workers asked many questions of BNSF about their proposed road and railroad operations. No satisfactory answers were given. Railroad workers rejected the proposal by an overwhelming 86% majority. We know that one-person train crews are inherently unsafe and a real danger to the public. Before closing, I'd simply like to direct your attention to a handout and that includes FRA, Federal Railroad Administration, grade crossing statistics. In Minnesota, we had an 11.3% increase in grade crossing incidents on public and private crossings over 2013. We had a 60% increase in private and public grade crossing incidents over the prior year. And in the four-year mark, from 2011 to 2014, we had a four-year high of 59 grade crossing collisions. We'd also like to point out in the packet letters from our collective bargaining branch of our union that says clearly safety is not a matter of collective bargaining. So in closing, as train crews, we are Minnesotans first. The public safety issue before you is one that will define the moral fabric of our society. This is about corporate citizenship and across the state of Minnesota. We request your support and ask that you base your decision based on the best interest of public safety in this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Who would like to go next?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Larry Mann. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C. Just as a matter of background, I was a principal draftsman of the Federal Railroad Safety Act in 1970, before many of you were born. And I have been involved in railroad safety legislation and regulatory matters since that time for more than 45 years. So I think I can give you some background as to the technical aspects here, as well as relate to you the arguments of the railroad industry and why they are invalid. One of the basic arguments of the rail industry is that there are technological advancements that should be taken into consideration by you in lieu of two-person crews. Well, the technological advancements they are talking about, one is known as positive train control. That is a GPS-type advancement that would prevent trains from colliding with each other. However, the federal regulation only will cover about 20 to 30% of the rail industry lines. Secondly, the railroads have now gone to Congress and have sought an extension to 2020 to put that technology into practice. The other that they mention is remote control operations. Well, in the senator's amendment, we are excluding remote control operations in yards from the requirement of two-person crew. Another basic argument of the rail industry is that there have been many safety improvements over the years, and they mention going back to the 80s, safety has improved a lot. For example, they say there have been less injuries. Well, back in the 80s, there were about 700,000 or 800,000 railroad workers. Today, there are 200,000 railroad workers, a little more. But so obviously, there are going to be less injuries and less deaths. But you have read in the papers and saw on television these crude oil trains that are exploding all over the country. We're talking about 100 car loads of train movement carrying 30,000 gallons of hazardous crude oil that explodes. That can wipe out a community, as it did in Lac Megantic in Canada, and it's likely to do that again if something's not done about it by the Federal Railroad Administration and the Department of Transportation. Also, they claim that grade crossing collisions have decreased. Well, there are over 2,000 grade crossing collisions a year in this country and over 200 deaths a year in this country. That's more than 4 deaths a week in the United States at grade crossings. It's outrageous. The fact that they've been reduced, sure, a lot of crossings have been eliminated, but there are many ways to protect crossings. That's another issue for another day, but I just want to point that out to you. The another argument is that passenger trains have only one-person crew. Well, that's just not accurate. You take Amtrak, for example, which I have some personal knowledge about. The conductor on that train must monitor radios, the speed, and signal indications, in addition to many other things that the Federal Railroad Administration has mandated if they are going to be a certified conductor on passenger trains and freight trains as well. I'm just not familiar with Metro Transit, but I can certainly tell you that throughout the country, there are more than one crew member on passenger trains. I don't know of one in the country that doesn't have more. Lastly, deals with a provision of the law that I specifically drafted. The rail industry claims preemption. I handle matters throughout the country in states, and I don't know of one state that the railroad industry has not brought up the issue of preemption. Well, first, as to the issue of preemption, last year, the Federal Railroad Administration stated that they intended to mandate two-person crews on certain trains. They stated that they were going to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking. That's not happened. It may never happen. We don't know. But the point is, it may be a couple years or several years, or it may not happen at all. And until such time as it is a specific regulation, preemption is not the issue. And just to mention briefly what the preemption law requires, and just as a matter of background, this preemption section was a primary concern of the state regulatory commissions back in 1970. They, along with the rail workers, would not agree unless these specific provisions were adopted by Congress, and Congress did. And in effect, it states that till the Secretary prescribes a regulation covering the specific subject matter of a safety law or regulation, the state may regulate it. And then there's a provision for local safety hazard, even if the federal government does regulate it. Well, the Supreme Court has weighed in on this. And what the Supreme Court has held is that unless the federal regulation substantially subsumes the subject matter, a state regulation is not preempted. Well, here, there has been no regulation. So clearly, there is no preemption at this stage. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mann. Mr. Brown. All right, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Nick Kadich. I am the Safety and Legislative Representative for UTU Smart Transportation Division, Local 1067 in northern Minnesota. I'm a trainman of 11 years working for the CN between Duluth and the Canadian border. Over the past several years, train crews on CN are being instructed by train dispatchers in Homewood, Illinois, to block public road crossings. This is occurring weekly on our main line, especially at the highway crossings for the Britt and Haley sidings. When we are instructed to block a crossing, we must comply with instructions or face a charge of insubordination and dismissal from service. We are put in an impossible situation, but we do protest these unsafe orders. Our job is to ensure our trains move safely. Our standard operation for decades is to get off the locomotive and separate the train at the crossing and leave it open for public and emergency vehicles for safe passage until the train is ready to depart. For over 200 train crew members in northern Minnesota, we're very concerned that the state act as soon as possible to assure two persons on all trains. If there is only one person on a train, there will be no way we can open a crossing. Two-person crews will assure that we are on our trains and in position to get emergency responders and the general public over railroad crossings without delay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kadich. Brown.
Good evening, Chairman Dibble and esteemed members of this committee.
My name is Dave Brown, for the record. I am the Minnesota State Legislative Chairman, National Region 3 Chairman for the National Association of State Chairmen, representing the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen of the International Brotherhoods of Teamsters. It's a long title, but it's been put together over 150 years. And being that, for over 150 years, the BLET has worked with the industry, the government, and other rail unions to make certain that railroads provide for the safety of our members, the public, and the environment. On behalf of more than 48,000 active BLET members and 150,000 IBT rail conference members, I want to express my appreciation for the opportunity to provide this committee with our position requiring maintaining train crews of at least two persons in the cab of every locomotive freight train. I would like to add that we support and fully agree with the previous testimony of the Sheet Metal Air Transportation Union members. And I would, after that, I would like to keep this brief because we'll probably be touching on a lot of the same issues. I've been working on the railroad for over 44 years. I've held ground service positions, including conductor, for 22 years. And at this time, I'm currently working as a locomotive engineer, qualified and licensed for passenger, commuter, and freight. I reject the notion that positive train control provides a justification for reducing crew size, as the railroads have contended. The implementation of PTC as a pretext to reducing train crew size would be taking one step forward and three steps backwards. PTC is simply another safety overlay of operating systems utilizing global positioning satellites, Wi-Fi, cell tower, and digital technology, in which trains will be kept apart in the majority of circumstances, but not in every circumstance. For instance, when I began my railroad career, we had what we call the dead man pedal to slow or stop a train if the engineer or crew became incapacitated. Today we have an alerter switch that will slow or stop a train. PTC is another tool to provide for the safe handling of the train. It doesn't respond at all to crossing incidents, derailments, or mechanical failures. There have been ideas by the carriers to have a person placed in locations that could be 50 or more miles apart to assist trains. This is not a realistic solution, as trains travel in many remote locations with little to no road access. Road traffic, weather conditions, vehicle problems, and many other issues should be concerning to our safety and, most important, the public safety. We are the first responders to grade crossing incidents, derailments, and many issues that occur on a daily basis. Having immediate and prompt response time with the existing two persons in the cab of a locomotive is essential in addressing any and all situations that can and do happen with crossings, track, rail cars, equipment failures, and various other incidents. Because of two-person crews, there have been train derailments where the severity was reduced by the immediate response of a crew member going back and pulling cars away from the derailed cars. This recently occurred in, Phil had mentioned, Castleton, North Dakota, but also in Mount Carbon, West Virginia, and very recently in Galen, Illinois. The conductor's immediate response by going back to separate the train blocking a crossing after a crossing is essential. One of many cases recently occurred just outside of the city of Larimore, North Dakota, when a BNS train collided with a school bus full of children. The train was blocking the crossing. The conductor immediately went back to separate the train so medical personnel and ambulances could attend to the injured. There was two fatalities in that incident. There would have been more if that crossing hadn't been cut. It is that second person on every freight train that is first to respond and the first to attend each and every situation behind the locomotive. The professional men and women working on our state and nation's railroads serve on the front lines of this industry. We are dedicated to its safety and the public safety. Our organization and all the other railroad labor organizations are committed to working towards solutions for the complex and multifaceted problems facing our industry. Our perception and that of rail labor of this public safety issue differs considerably from that of the railroads. Our vision of safety comes from the rank and file, the backbone of this nation's railroads. It comes from the highly skilled, professional, hard-minute working men and women working days, nights, holidays, 24/7, 365 days a year, moving this nation's freight. The Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen will seek opportunities to work with this committee, the carriers, and federal agencies on legislative and regulatory priorities that strengthen the safety of moving America's passengers and freight as a normal course of our activity. We are uniquely positioned to provide sound judgment and solid ideas regarding recommendations that make our industry safer and more secure. Once again, I want to thank Chairman Dibble and esteemed members of this committee for the opportunity to bring my testimony forward, and I ask and encourage your support of Senate File 918, providing for two persons in the cab of the locomotive on every freight train on each Class 1 and Class 2 railroads in this great state.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. I see Ms. Schaubach on the list, but I don't see her in the room. Anyone? Who else would like to testify? Mr. Sweeney? We have Mr. Appitz. All right. Thank you. Welcome. Welcome, Mr. Appitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. I'm here on behalf of the Class 1 railroads as well, who are spending some time over in the House dealing with another issue related to a $33 million annual assessment that has been proposed by Governor Dayton. I'm listening to this testimony, and I'd just like to start out by saying, why now? Why do we need this bill now? When we have negotiated crew size issues for decades in this country, and why now has that suddenly become a safety issue? Perhaps because safety issues are an issue that the state can generally deal with outside the federal parameter. But I must say, it's interesting that all of a sudden this has become a safety issue when for decades we've dealt with this as a crew size issue collective bargaining situation. It is a collective bargaining issue. It has been for a long, long, long time. I was going to kind of go into a litany of the sort of things we've been talking about for the last couple of years in this committee and other committees where the railroads have been brought to where issues have been brought to our attention. I was going to talk about the three or four bills we passed last year to deal with railroad safety. Moving crude oil in the state of Minnesota through the state of Minnesota required us to make contributions to training for first responders in the state, required us to provide funding for track inspectors, required us to work with the Pollution Control Agency to look at response plans, and then required us to put lighting in our yards in some instances where there might not have been. And then I was going to talk about, as well, the new things that have come forward this year, the $100 million new taxes that have been proposed by the governor and are in both of these bodies right now, presented both as a tax for grade crossing improvements, as well as a tax on personal property of railroads, which we don't charge to any other commercial industrial property holder in this state, which by federal law is probably preempt. But we won't get into that particular thing. We could talk about truck size and weight increases. We could talk about a variety of other issues. But we're here to talk about two crew size. And so I have to ask you, why now would we go forward with this bill? This bill undermines the collective bargaining process that has existed for years. And by that I mean, how does one party trust another party in that collective bargaining agreement when one party leaves before the ink is dry and comes up here and asks for changes in the situation that they've just negotiated? It ignores technological advancements. PTC that you just heard about, positive train control, was a mandate by the United States Congress placed on the railroad industry about 5 years ago. Congressman Oberstar had a lot to do with that. And it was designed to improve the safety of railroad operations and passenger operations across the country. It was not intended to be a crew size reduction measure. That's not what the Congress intended when that was brought forward, and you shouldn't be believing that sort of thing. It'll make trains safer and train operations safer. And it's a $15 billion mandate on the railroad industry. This ignores the safety improvements that railroads have been making over the last several decades. We've had a reduction of 79% and 91% in the incidents that have occurred with regard to grade crossings and hazardous material incidences. And that's why crew sizes have been going down over that period of time from 5 to 2 in most instances. This bill does not apply to passenger trains. It does not apply to the train that runs right out there. It does not apply to Amtrak and other trains. It does not require two people in the cabs. You just heard said that there are additional staff on those trains. Yep, that's true. There is. And that's because that's the way those operations run. and it ignores the rulemaking process that's going on right now with the Federal Railroad Administration. The Federal Railroad Administration is going to open the comment period for this very issue running from June to August. They're going to take testimony, and they're going to issue some sort of finding with regard to this. Any action you take here might be preempted when the Federal Railroad Administration brings forward their particular findings on this. So I reiterate the question, why now, when we've been doing this for decades, would you pass a bill that would require what is being done already today in most of the railroad operations in the country? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions, members? So, Mr. Abbott, quick question for you. The rulemaking process, can you tell us, because your testimony is slightly different than earlier testimony, can you help us reconcile the difference? Mr. Mann said it is unclear whether or not the rulemaking process is going to go forward. You seem fairly certain it is going to open up in June or July.
If I'm not mistaken, I heard Mr. Mann say that they hadn't issued a rule and there was no evidence that there would be or that they were intending to. I won't put words in his mouth, but there is rulemaking, a public notice for comment that's coming out in June and it will run until August. At least that's what we've read in the Federal Register.
Okay. Mr. Mann.
How about the author? Would that be okay?
Senator Rest, I'm the chair, and I'll call on whomever I choose to call on. If you would like to respond, you are welcome to as the author, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I listened very closely to, and I certainly will defer to the experts who are here, as I did earlier. But I listened to Mr. Abbott's primary question is, why now? And it seems to me that it is because safety issues have really risen to the top of our concerns about the operations of trains in Minnesota and across the country. And further, that with talking about passenger trains of the LRT, those passenger trains and the LRT don't carry crude oil tankers, and the freight trains do. So I think it's very legitimate for us to be considering safety issues. And in particular, we know that not only are the derailments becoming an increasing concern, but we also know that the number of cars that are used to transport crude oil have exponentially increased in just the last few years. So why now? Indeed, why now?
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Questions, members? Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Abbott,
yes, sir.
You've indicated that you believe that this issue would be proper for to be taken care of in collective bargaining. Is this issue currently covered under the current collective bargaining agreement?
It's my understanding.
Mr. Abbott.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, it's my understanding that it is and it has been for some time.
Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Newman.
To any of the folks at the testifying table, if you would look at line 11 through 14, lays out some criminal penalties, beginning with a misdemeanor and ending up at a felony level for anybody that operates or controls these trains. And the way I read it, that could be the engineer. It could be someone in intermediate management. It could be somebody in management with the railroad. And it strikes me as being a really odd clause to put in a bill of this type. And I just, if you wouldn't mind, I have a hunch that I'll probably see this again in another committee, but I would just like to hear your comments on that, on the penalty provisions.
To whomever would like to respond.
Mr. Chairman and Senator,
Mr. Mann.
A railroad worker, an employee, is not going to violate this section unless ordered by the railroad. There's just no way that an employee is going to operate unless instructed to by the management. So a person includes the railroad.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Qualley wanted to respond. Did you, sir?
All right. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I would just like to comment on the comments prior and the question on the collective bargaining. We have written this legislation, and at line 1.9, it is without a crew composed of a minimum of two individuals. That is the state legislation we are proposing. That has nothing to do with contracts. It does not say who that is from the state level. That could be two managers. That could be two train crews. That could be two policemen if they're qualified to operate trains. We have specifically left the collective bargaining piece out of this state bill. Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, on the penalty provision. I understand. Is it Mr. Mann?
Yes.
I understand what you're saying, but I would point out to you that the bill specifically says a person operating the train. And in my estimation, that easily could be the railroad engineer. And nowhere do I see the railroad, the company, defined as a person in the bill. So it's just a comment. We don't have to debate the issue at this point, but I do see a good deal of ambiguity and it's just kind of a curious clause in this particular bill with the way it's written.
So to whomever would like to respond, Mr. Appitz.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a response to that particular question. I'd just like to ask the witness a question, if I may. Mr. Mann?
Sure.
Is this the language that appears in the Wisconsin and the Arizona statutes?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Anything further? Senator Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to offer the A1 amendment.
All right. We have an amendment.
We never did in the hospital. This is
a Mr. Chair and members.
Idiosyncrasy. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you see that amendment here, I can start talking about it. I do disagree with Senator Rest. You know, she talked about the difference between passenger trains is that they're hauling people instead of crude oil. Well, members, I would argue that the lives of the people are certainly more important than the cargo that's being hauled by crude oil, and maybe even the damage, how horrific it may be, could be done by crude oil. Whoops. Okay. All right.
I didn't do it.
It's the cameraman trying
to need a little safety in the room here. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, and so what this amendment does is simply add passengers as well as freight, and then adds a commuter rail train and train providing light transit also to this. As you heard testimony right now, those trains often only have one person, which I can argue cannot get out of the engine. As I observed around the Capitol here, those engineers are not able to get out of the train, as you described as a feature of your equipment that is valuable and is a significant contributor to the safety. And so, members, I'd ask you to support this amendment based on the fact that passengers are just as important as the freight. And in my short time here in researching as well, I do want to remind you that there's been 12 deaths caused by the Blue Line. That's the Blue Line light rail train has hit 12 people since its inception and killed them. And then also the Green Line has been operating for such a short time. There's been one death already. And I would argue if you take that times the 30 largest cities in the country that maybe have some type of rail passenger rail nationwide, I would argue that those deaths are clearly just as high as deaths at grade crossings that you've heard Mr. Mann and Mr. Qualley and others talk about. And so, Mr. Chair, I'd roll call the vote on this amendment as well.
All right. Thank you. A roll call has been requested. A roll call will be granted. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think I already spoke against the amendment before it was offered. I would ask members to I would ask members to vote no. There might be at some point consideration of passenger trains, but that is not what the safety concerns that have risen to the top here is driving this bill. And it's my understanding that light rail transit operates under a different statute, set of statutes, and so I don't think we want to go there. So I would respectfully ask members to vote no.
All right. Anything further, members? All right. Clerk will take the roll.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Mr. Chair,
wanted to clarify. So can Council just quickly explain what the difference or what Class 1 and Class 2 railroad means in the original language of the bill, just to understand that?
Mr. Chairman, point of order, actually.
Senator Westrom?
We should vote on the amendment, and then getting back to the bill, the debate should be limited to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, it's going to inform how I'm going to vote on the amendment, because I want to know what that covers, if it covers other parts of commuter train. I just have to understand what that definition is.
All right. Thank you. Council.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the break point in front of me, and maybe one of the railroad people could offer that definition.
Mr. Chairman, I think one of our testifiers could explain the difference between one and two, and it also is not applying to the short lines, but Mr. Mann or Mr. Qualley could tell you the difference.
Class one and class two, Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, as I understand it, the Federal Railroad Administration designates railroads class one, two, and three based on the total number of route miles, revenues, and employees generally.
Great. Thank you. So basically, it's the size of the railroad. So the BNSF, Union Pacific, Canadian Pacific, Canadian National in Minnesota are considered Class 1 railroads, for example.
Mr. Chairman, there are 7 Class 1 railroads in the country.
Great. Thank you. And then it kind of steps down from there, Senator Francis. Does that help?
It does. It does. It just helps some. And just for the record, I didn't hear Senator Rest say that she had disregard for passengers. I think Senator Peterson, in all fairness, she just made a different statement than what you said, and I just want to make that clear. I don't think the senator, and I don't want to speak for her, but I don't think she has disregard for passengers. It's the intent of her bill seems to be more on that particular Class 1, Class 2, and doesn't deal with commuter train or light rail, as your amendment suggests. So just for the record.
Great. Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would remind you, I would encourage you to look at 1.4 of my amendment. It does include passenger trains, which is not included in Senator Rest's bill. So a derailment of a passenger train, for example, right now would be included with this bill, and commuter trains. And again, I would just remind you again, we've had 14 people just in this city killed by the blue line, and we've had one just in the last year killed by the green line, and I find it a little surprising that members of this committee are going to go on public record voting against the safety of the passengers on these very same rail lines that we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I would not impugn Senator Peterson's motives, and I hope that he will not choose to do that by members that don't vote with him on his amendment. As I mentioned, this bill is focused on freight trains. If we want to consider what the structure of increasing safety on passenger trains and LRT is, I would suggest that we come up with another bill that addresses those concerns, and I would be happy to work with Senator Peterson on such a bill. But the focus of this bill is on the major freight lines that operate not only in Minnesota, but obviously those classifications exist throughout the state, the country as well. And again, I would encourage members to vote no.
Great. Thank you, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Qualley, are the conductors and engineers on the Amtrak, a passenger rail, are they members of your union?
Mr. Qualley.
Yes, they are.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Qualley.
We certainly feel your pain and share your concern. From our perspective, including light rail, it is a really a different animal from the heavy passenger and commuter trains. We defer to our chief author and the wisdom of the legislature, and we concur with her assessment that this should perhaps be thought over in a separate piece of legislation. Thank you. We thank you for your concern, Senator.
All right. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a co-author in this bill, and when I was invited to look at it and thought about it, it was my signing onto it. It was all about the size, the complexity, the speed, and all of what goes with the actions of the railroad, i.e. the engineers largely, when you have a problem. And I hadn't thought about the commuter part at the time, but certainly a train traveling through our urban cities is every bit as complex as accidents occur, maybe, frankly, more than it might be out in the hinterlands as accidents occur. And it just seems to me that, from my perspective at least, the same reasons for me signing on to the initial bill are the same reasons for me wanting to perhaps support this amendment. I think it's reasonable and good. When a train gets in trouble, you need more than one person. I'm sure you do.
Right. Anything further, members? All right. Clerk will take the roll.
Senator Dibble.
No.
Senator Carlson.
No.
Senator Champion.
No.
Senator Franzen.
No.
Senator Jensen.
No.
Senator Kent.
No.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Senator Newman.
Yes.
Senator Osmek. Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Senator Pratt.
Yes.
Senator Reinert.
No.
Senator Rest.
No.
Senator Senjum.
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni.
No.
Senator Westrum.
Yes.
Senator Wieger.
No.
On a vote of 6 yeses and 10 noes, the motion does not prevail. All right.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 918 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
All right. Thank you. You heard Senator S. Motion. Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, I have one question, but perhaps if you tell me that this is something that could be handled in Judiciary, I will, you know, oblige. My concern is twofold about this particular bill, but the one issue that I'm going to narrow in on seems to be articulated at line 1.10 to 1.14. And if I might, the scenario that I would ask the testifier, Mr. Qualley, to answer for me is what happens in a scenario where a person who's higher up in the company says that this particular train or locomotive has to move with only one person at the helm. That is communicated to a supervisor who then says to his line staff, which is the person who's going to drive the or operate the train, that he or she must go forward. Then if they are stopped or if they're cited, then who under my scenario would be in violation of the law as articulated at lines 1.10 to 1.14.
So, Senator Champion, I think it is important to focus on line 1.7, in which it says, no person operating or controlling a Class 1 or Class 2 railroad. So this is whomever is in control of the company, who's ever making the managerial decisions for the company.
And so with that, Mr. Chair, I don't see that in this bill. I mean, if you could tell me where it says the company, when we look at 1.10 to 1.114, being a lawyer, I would look at that language, and then these other persons work for the company, so they are employees of the company. So I'm just trying to understand whether I'm off base or whether this is something that should go to judiciary, and we wrestle with it in judiciary.
That would be my preference. Senator Rest.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, I think that I'm trying to think about how we use that term person in tax law. And when we want to speak about a single human being, we use the term individual. And the word person can be used in a larger context. But I also would leave that to the members on the Judiciary Committee unless we can get further edification about how that term is used in the law with regard to the railroads.
Mr. Chairman, I can add that in all of the Federal Railroad Safety Statutes, the word person includes the railroad.
But it's not limited to. See, that's where being a lawyer helps, right? Yeah. Because when you look at this language, even though we're trying to gloss over it because they want to just push it forward, a person means anyone. Anyone there who violates this, technically, one single incident, it doesn't matter. They can, you know, I'm just trying to get some clarity as to what their intent is and what I see there. But, of course, again, well, Mr. Chair, I'll defer to you because I am ready to go as well.
Yeah, Senator Champion, the person has to be the person who operates or controls the railroad. Not the train.
Not the train.
The railroad.
The railroad.
Mm-hmm. So,
I'm just saying it doesn't.
So we can hang out with Senator Newman. Who else in here is on judiciary?
Okay, we'll fix it there.
In judiciary.
Mr. Chair, to this point, if I might, I just want to point out that this particular bill has got anything to do with federal law, and federal law isn't going to govern the definition of a person in Minnesota, insofar as this bill is concerned. I think Senator Champion is right. I think there is a significant ambiguity in the way this is drafted. I also think that this will get picked apart in judiciary. I just have little or no doubt about that. And, you know, and Mr. Chair, if your committee wants to work on it, fine, but it'll get worked over in judiciary. And I assume that's where it's going from here.
So. It is, yes. Mm-hmm. That's the motion. All right. Anything further, members? All right. All in favor of Senator Rest's motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Motion carries. All right, members. We are adjourned. We'll see you Wednesday.
Praise be to God.
See you.
I see. Any of this.